The last time when we studied together, we were in Romans 8:29, talking about how God has predestined the called to be conformed to the image of His Son. And we talked about the possibilities of meaning in regard to that. And I am inclined to believe that what Paul was dealing with there is actually explained a little better in Philippians, where he talks about how our vile bodies are going to be conformed to the image of His glorious body, because He has predestined each of us to be delivered completely from all of the Adamic connection that we have. He predestined us to have access to a totally different physical makeup that would actually completely sever us from any connection to Adam. He has already delivered us from the consequences of Adam's transgression, according to Romans chapter 5. By being placed into Christ, we have the forgiveness of sins and all of the things that are associated with that. And at the spiritual and emotional levels, we have been saved. But our bodies have been consigned to the processes of disintegration called the bondage to corruption, and they're going to suffer that until we die or the Lord comes and delivers us instantaneously. But in any case, the big issue in verse 29 about this predestined to become conformed to the image of His Son has to do with God's predetermination that His deliverance of us is going to be complete, total at some point. And we have to be reminded that verse 29 and 30 are actually simply Paul's presentation of the truths that enable us to believe Romans 8:28. In Romans 8:28, he actually said that God is bending everything that occurs, every experience that we have. He is actively working, as a present active verb, to produce good out of that for those who are the called according to His purpose. And then up from that, the first part of the verse, those who love Him. So in that regard, what he's really doing is telling us that it's all going to come out right in the end. And verse 28 is a declaration that's often been used for comfort by people who are going through very difficult things. And that's why it was given. It wasn't given for us to fall back on when everything's going great. It was given to us to fall back on when things look really bad. And the classic illustration, of course, was the experience of the two on the road to Emmaus who had left Jerusalem in total despair. They thought that Jesus was the Christ, and they had committed their lives to being His disciples, and He ended up being crucified by Rome and buried, and they just headed out of town. That was the end of that. It was a total waste of the last 7 years until Jesus showed up on the road. And they recognized Him, and they realized that His earlier declarations that He would be raised on the third day were actually true. So that the death of Christ, which is the worst possible thing that could happen in a creation of a loving God, for sin to actually have the enormous impact on God that it had at the crucifixion, that horrible thing, the worst possible thing, was turned into the enormous good of the forgiveness of sins and the building of a whole organism of people who have been regenerated and brought into the kingdom of light and the eternal glory and all of that. So all of the good that's coming out of that horrible thing is just a classic illustration of how God is turning everything together to good for those who are called according to His purpose. We made the observation last time that the predestination concept is the second of five, and it's the only one that's expanded. He foreknew, He predestined, He called, He justified, He glorified. But the only thing that's expanded is this predestination thing. And so we spend our time talking about that issue. And in our studies, what we've actually seen is that Paul is dealing with those who are the called according to purpose, having the confidence in the bad times of life that God is going to turn this into their good. And that is reinforced by his earlier teaching that the suffering that we have to endure is not worthy to be compared to the glory that's to be revealed. That's verse 18. So the point here is that he actually means this. Every negative aspect of our experience that we consider to be negative, the things that are hurtful and painful and all that, are going to be turned to our good. That's his commitment to us, and the proof of it is in verses 29 and 30. The foreknown, the predestining, the calling, the justification, the glorification. So, he wants us to be capable of genuinely believing that God is present and active right now in history, even though every one of the verbs in 29 and 30 that have to do with God deciding something or doing something are aorist. They're past tense. He's done this. He foreknew. He predestined. He called. He justified. He glorified. And all of us know that the glorification thing is not even promised until we're predestined to be conformed to the image of His Son. That's when the glorification is going to actually take place in respect to us, but in respect to God, it's a done deal. So, verse 28 posits God actively working now, but verses 29 and 30 say the reason we can have confidence that He's doing this is because He's already made these decisions and taken these actions. So, that's where we are. He's trying to make sure that in the midst of the unpleasant things of life, we actually believe that this is going to result in good for us. We also saw in our introduction to verses 29 and 30 that there are five things, and the middle one is the calling. Those He predestined, He called. Well, that's the focus, because according to verse 28, this turning everything to good is turning everything to good for those who are the called. So the calling issue is a big issue. Even though it's not expanded like the predestination thing is, it is still the central issue, and it is a big time issue. And so this evening what we're going to do is we're going to look into the issues that surround the fact that God has called those whom He has predestined to be conformed to the glorious image of His Son. He foreknew, He predestined, those He predestined, He called. So, we're going to start with this issue of the call as a past tense event. The Romans as believers, for them, the call is also a past tense event because they are believers. In other words, God called them and they responded to that call with faith and they became believers. And so when they got this letter, they could say, well, God foreknew me, He predestined me to be conformed to the image of His Son, and He called me. And they could go along with the past tense idea because it was all past tense to them too. And even the next one, the justification, that's past tense to them too. But the glorification thing is not past tense to them, but it's presented as past tense to somebody. So we have to just keep in mind that the call is a call that is not only determined by God because those He predestined He called, but the calling is also presented as something that hadn't occurred until He actually called them in time and in history and their experience and knowing. So though it is passed to them now, since they're believers, the calling is presented as something that God did. Just like the foreknowing, it was an intimate knowledge of people who didn't even exist yet. And we talked about that. One of the things that we're going to look at is the calling as a past action, and then we'll look at it as a central issue in terms of the ultimate good, and then the place that Paul puts on calling in Romans. But at the level of calling, I think this is where there is an obvious bleed over. We talked about transcendence and immanence. Transcendence being God's existence beyond and above creation and time, so that there was, before there was any created time or existence of any other creatures, God existed. And His transcendence above His creation means that He's outside of it. He's not compelled by it. And yet, at the same time that the transcendence of God is true, there is also the antithetical reality that God is working, Romans 8:28, in the processes, so He's imminent, He's here in the midst of it. And as a consequence of that, when he says those he predestined, he called in verse 30, he's talking about a connection between that transcendent reality and his imminent interaction with human beings as a bleed over from his external existence outside of creation to his present involvement in the creation activities of time. And, you know, when you look at knowledge, for example, he foreknew. His foreknowing was a knowing of people that didn't exist. So it's a knowledge that's prior to the existence of the known. And we talked about the difficulty that that creates. But we also talked about some of the biblical statements that kind of diminish that difficulty. But it's presented as a static reality for God. And the reason it's a static reality is because omniscience is a static character. God has always known everything there is to know, both possible, real, and potential, or not even possible. He's known everything that's an object of knowledge, and he always has, because that's an essential aspect of his nature. So it's a static reality, and foreknowing as a subset of omniscience and wisdom. Technically, I suppose, outside of time, there's no need for wisdom. Because outside of time, you don't have options to decide. There are no, well, should we do this or should we do that, because those don't exist. But God is presented as the all-wise God, the omni-wise one. Which means that that wisdom concept is an immanent concept in time, and yet foreknowledge as a subset of that omniscience is where the transcendence immanence thing is starting to bleed together, so that you have to think of God in both ways. As far as the knowledge before the existence of the known, that's just the static reality. God exists most fundamentally in the transcendent sense over and above all creation, because there was a reality where there was no creation. Creation had a beginning. It's presented in the scriptures as not ever ending. God's not ever going to cut it off. But it did have a beginning. And God's not a part of the beginning in the sense that it's an essential part of him. He's not, like the polytheists say, he's not a part of everything that's existing simply because he created it. But nonetheless, knowledge is that static thing of transcendence. And then you have this predetermination, which we argued last time, means that omniscience by itself doesn't determine anything. Predetermination means that at some point there were some options that were created. And in the creation of the options, then you had decisions that had to be made. And the decisions that had to be made, according to the predetermination, were made before. And so, in a very real sense, omniscience, wisdom, creation, and then predetermination, these are all things that were going on, if I can say it this way, in the mind of God. They're just static realities. They're there. And predetermination prior to the existence of the determined is simply a decision of God in the realm of his existence above the creation in regard to the creation. He wrote our names in the Lamb's Book of Life before the foundation of the world, before he actually took action, created time, created the universe, he made a decision, because the very issue of creation was a decision. He decided to do this for whatever reasons. But when we get to those he predestined, these he also called, we're now moving into the area that is not just in the mind of God. He is now going to actively do something, even if it's just saying something. That's what calling is. But it's a summons too. It's addressed to somebody else, and it's a summons for a purpose. And, of course, that's what he said in verse 28. They're called according to purpose. God determined the purpose before he ever initiated any activity, but once the activity was initiated, then there were the developments of the things that were known ahead of time, and as they developed, he actually intervened in the lives of individuals and summoned them. They were the ones who he had foreknown and predetermined, and he called them. He actively moved. Foreknowledge and predetermination is not an activity. Calling is. It's an action taking. And this is the first declaration of the action taken by God in the five supporting arguments that he is actively working. The fact that he calls and called, or maybe we should turn that around, the fact that he called and then calls indicates that he's very serious about Romans 8:28. These people that I've called and am calling, as they come to the point in their experience where the summons is extended to them, and there are countless, I mean, everybody has that. Everybody, whoever comes into the purpose of God in terms of the benefits, is called by God. The illustrations are in every believer's life. Nobody becomes a believer without this experience of being summoned by God. But, for an example, Saul of Tarsus on the road to Damascus is a classic. Paul said in Galatians that he was separated from his mother's womb by God. But for the next 32 or 33 or 34 years, there was no evidence that God was anywhere around in terms of Saul of Tarsus activity, behavior, or anything else. And so he said in Galatians, when it pleased God to reveal his son to me, that was the road to Damascus thing. And all that means is God was involved in Saul of Tarsus' origins, in his mother's womb. He was involved in his childhood and in his theological training and all of the stuff that was going on. But he was a silent individual in the process. He was working, but it wasn't obvious. Until on the road to Damascus, it became obvious. And after that, the obviousness of it began to develop in the experience of Paul. That's the way it is for every individual believer. They don't know they're called by God until God calls them. And then they know that they have been summoned by God. And after the summons, the justification, glorification issues enter into the picture, and that directly affects their experience in this world. So this is the point where calling becomes the initial action of God in time. So that the preliminary stuff that guarantees Romans 8:28 is true, is the foreknowledge and the predetermination, but the calling is actually him making it work now. He knew it was going to happen. He determined certain things were going to happen, and now he's making it happen. And that's what the calling thing is. It's a foreknown, predetermined activity, but it's an action taken by God. And it's the first of the actions that support our confidence that he is actively, daily involved. And it's presented as a past actual event, but it insists upon an equal reality within time. So you have this transcendent reality and the immanent reality blending together, because I told one guy one time that prophecy was just history ahead of time, and history would eventually catch up with the words that God had predicted. Well, that's the way it is, because God is actively working together for good. So there has to be this equal reality within time. So that's why I call it first obvious bleed over from God out there to God in here and involved in the process. And every one of us has a past that included a summons from God into the truth, whatever our personal testimony of that is. Every one of us had one. For some of us, it's more climactic than others. For some of us, the conflict was greater and the decision was harder because of the way we were and the summons of God. I mean, Saul of Tarsus had a terrible time when Jesus of Nazareth appeared to him on the road. Because that was a major crisis event for Saul of Tarsus, where he had to recognize that his entire theological orientation, from the time he first began to be a student of the scriptures and a student of Gamaliel, proved that he hadn't learned anything yet. How could I have been so wrong so long? Must have been his theme for the next 3 days. But nonetheless, that would have been, I mean, people have crisis experiences like that, where coming to Christ is a major, major issue. And some of us just believe the gospel when we hear it, and it's not a big crisis thing. We don't fight against it, or I'm sure there is some resistance along, but hey, when I heard Mark Williamson explain the gospel to me in Sunday school and told me that I could receive Christ as my Savior and have this promise of eternal life applied to me, I just did it. It wasn't a big deal. It became a big deal because it began a whole new track. I mean, I became a child of God. But it wasn't, I didn't fight it, I didn't wrestle with it or that kind of thing. But everybody's experience is unique, but everybody has the experience. Everybody is summoned by God who is summoned by God. And everybody who is summoned knows they've been summoned. There are people who resist the knowledge that they've been summoned, but they still know it's God summoning them. It's hard for them to deal with that, especially if they don't respond to the summons. But the fact is, everybody who is summoned knows he's being summoned. That's why they are without excuse. So every one of us has this past where we were summoned into the gospel truth. That the scripture here declares that it happened before time doesn't erase the fact that it happened in time. And as action, it almost necessitates the existence of time as we know it. Because what is time for us but the succession of actions? I mean, how do you measure time? The passing of seconds. Or you could even say the passing of milliseconds. The fact that things happen after other things and the sequence continues and you're moved by the sequence away from this setting to another setting, that's how we view time. And however you define it, the huge philosophical problems with defining time. But the fact is, everybody measures time as a progression. And the very idea of a progression through time with a call of God in the middle of that means that the action has to be in a time frame. And so it's impossible for us to even think about events happening without time as a progression orientation. So as an action of time, this is the most effective support for Romans 8:28. Because Romans 8:28 just fiatly declares, by fiat it says, God is working in your days and in your experiences to bring this together for good eventually. That's a declaration, believable or not. But verses 29 and 30 say, now you ought to believe it. And so this action in time actually says, see, God is working in time. He did call, but he is calling. And that's what we studied in our studies of Paul's letters to the Thessalonians, that God is calling. And he does it on a continuing, ongoing basis, not just to the gospel, but calling on a pretty regular basis to his children, saying, come over here and stand beside me. He summons us to himself. And we talked about how the call can be summarized as a question. Are you going to trust me or not? That's the call of God. When the truth is made clear, people have to decide whether they're going to resist it or embrace it. And unfortunately, people do resist it. Fortunately, people also embrace it. So, that's the background in terms of the call as a past action. But also, the fact that the call is in the middle of the five, and it is the called who are called according to purpose, this activity on God's part is working to their good. That's the central issue of this promise of ultimate good. God never says everything that happens is good, but he does declare that everything happens will be turned into good by his activity, so that even the worst case scenario can be confidently affirmed to be a part of what God is going to do when he confounds the wisdom of the wise and produces good out of this evil. And we will stand amazed and blessed when we see the glory that has come out of this suffering. So, Romans 8:28 is the commitment to those who are called according to purpose. It is the first time-forced reality in the description of God's support for us is his intention that we have this confidence that the call of God stands over the prior facts of omniscience-based foreknowledge, wisdom-based determination, and the following results of justification and glorification. Calling is in the center of this. This is the central issue of the ultimate good promise. So, what we have to try to understand is, why is the calling in the center of this whole issue? What is Paul's concept of the calling of God? And particularly in Romans. According to chapter 9, verse 11, just the next chapter over, he says, talking about Jacob and Esau, it's a verse 9 says, of chapter 9, this is the word of promise that was made to Abraham. This time I will come and Sarah will have a son. So that's one of the illustrations of the issue of the promise and the word of promise and the summons. But it says in verse 10, and not only this. So he's going to use Jacob and Esau as an illustration also. And he says in verse 11, though the twins were not yet born, had not done anything good or bad, in order that God's purpose according to election might stand, not because of works, but because of him who called. The issue of calling is fundamental here. He says, God has a purpose. And it's going to stand because he has eliminated works from it. And he has made it subject to his calling. That's what will make it stand. According to chapter 4, if you go back to his presentation that we haven't studied in this series, but nonetheless, he said in Romans chapter 4, in verse 16, for this reason, and he's talking about verse 15, the law brings about wrath. For this reason, it's by faith, so that it might be according to grace, in order that the promise might be certain. The only way the promise can be certain is if God doesn't allow anybody else's behavior to affect it. God can make a promise, and according to the end of the chapter 4, Abraham's peak development of faith was when he realized that the one who made the promise is the one who's got to keep it. When he fully realized that he didn't have to do anything to fulfill the promise of God to him, but God had to do everything that was necessary to bring it to pass. When he realized that, the tension of life just kind of dissipated. Because he's no longer responsible to make this happen. Sarah and Abraham, earlier, had felt the pressure to make it happen. And so they jumped through these hoops trying to make it happen. And Ishmael was a result of one of the hoops they jumped through that wasn't legitimate to make it happen. But finally, God got it through to them. Look, you're not responsible to make my promises come to pass. And it's just an enormous relief to realize, hey, I don't have to make this happen. It's going to happen because God promised it, not me. But that's what he's saying in verse 16 of chapter 4, that it had to be according to grace so that the promise could be certain. So in that respect, what he's actually doing is he's saying in chapter 9:11, that it was the call of God according to purpose that was going to make the promise sure. So the promise has to stand. The word is abide, to be impossible to erase it or nullify it. The purpose of God has to stand. The promise of God then comes along and gives us an insight into what he's got in mind, and the promise has to be sure. Well, the only way that can work is if God has said, look, bottom line, I'm going to make it happen. Because that's my job as God. And it's my responsibility as a person who makes promises and keeps them. So, if I've promised this couple, this child, and they're respectively 89 and 99 years old, and nobody believes that's going to happen, except I think Abraham did by that time, but Sarah certainly didn't. there were reasons why they didn't believe it was going to happen. And the primary reasons were two. Sarah had never been able to conceive, and now she's way too old to conceive. And Abraham, his body's considered now dead. So the ability to produce the promise of God is effectively eliminated from the human possibilities. That's God's whole point. When he says the revelation that the elder would serve the younger in Romans 9, it was given before the time of the existence of the two, before the twins were born. God just said, look, this is the way it's going to work. The younger is going to be over the older. The elder will serve the younger. And it's not going to be based on the fact that Jacob's a better guy. He's not a better person. He's not a morally superior individual. He's just like his brother. Jacob and Esau were both conniving, self-promoting, self-centered, sinful people. Before any of that was going to show up on in the stage of history, God just said, this is the way it's going to work. Well, when God makes those kind of declarations, then something's got to happen to be sure that this is the way it's going to work out. And the thing that the Romans 8:29 is or 28 says is God's at work to make this happen. And that's why in Romans 4 it says that the promise has to be rooted in grace so that the promise is sure. If it's rooted in the performance issues of human beings, we all know what human beings do. At the level of performance, human beings are incredible failures. And the only solution for that reality is if God, who doesn't fail, decides he's going to work in time to do it. So he makes it stand. So God's entrance into time with this call business is the outworking of what was foreknown and predetermined, but it was the foundation for what's going to be justified and glorified. In other words, calling is the central thing. God said this way it's going to work. He entered into time, made it work. The outworking of that is the future, the justification, glorification, realities. So, are there any real difficulties here? Well, there is this one. Twice in Matthew, chapter 20, verse 16 and 22:14, Jesus made this enigmatic kind of statement. Many are called, but few are chosen. In our text, choosing happens before calling. Predetermination happens before calling. But in Jesus' statements, in both of those contexts, he is dealing with people who are self-centered and motivated by evil issues. And in both cases, he says, many are called, few are chosen. And the implication of that is, well, there are lots of implications, but one of the implications of that is that God utters a calling way beyond what he's going to do about enforcing it or making it work. When we read Romans 8:28 and then 29 and 30, we see that those he called, he justified. But that's not all that he summoned. He justified, because it's not. According to Jesus, many are summoned. And the whole issue of being summoned by God is the root of Hebrews 3 and 4, where three times in two chapters he says, today, if you hear his voice, don't harden your heart, like those that did at Meribah and whatever in the wilderness. The whole point of the fact that human beings cannot make themselves believe what they don't believe, but they can make themselves resist what they know is true. So when people say, well, man has a volitional capacity where he can determine whether he wants to accept Jesus or not, there's some level of truth in that, but it is not at the level of faith. Every individual that is summoned by God knows God is summoning them, but not every individual responds with faith, because biblically, faith is yielding to the truth as it is. There are many illustrations in many texts of the scriptures of people who were confronted by God and they rejected him, and so he just walked off, left them. the Pharisees and the Sadducees and are the classic illustrations of the most vehement rejectors of God in the flesh, talking straight to them. In their hearing, looking in their eyes, saying things to them that they said, we will not accept that. And yet they knew it was true because many times what he said to them made them so angry they could just bite nails. And you don't get angry, that angry, unless there's some truth in what's been said. They know they've been called, but they don't respond by submitting to it. And that's why I say the maximum level of the volitional capacity of man is to stop resisting. It's not to believe. You already know it's true. But believing in the scriptures is not just knowing it's true. It's knowing it's true and cessation of the resistance that it is true, yielding to it. The scriptures would call it embracing it as true. But the fact is, that's the issue here. Jesus did say many are called, few are chosen, simply because the call of God goes out in a very real sense. If you start thinking about what's the nature of the call of God, do you hear him in English or in Spanish or in German or what's the deal? Well, the calling of God is probably as varied as there are individuals summoned. There are people who hear from God while the gospel is being preached. There are other people who hear from God where they're reading the scriptures. There are other people who hear from God when they hear a song that has truth in it, whether it's a secular song or a Christian one. The truth whacks them right upside the head and they say, ah, I never even thought of that before. And the light comes on. If you were to listen to the testimonies of several thousand people, you would be amazed, because I've been amazed with only hearing the testimony of a few. But you would be amazed at how some people come to know the Lord. It really worked. How did that work? Just some little passing phrase that went through their brain and got, and they were nailed. That's the summons of God. And the issue of the summons is not how he does it, but the effectiveness of it. They know that God has addressed them. They know it. That's the call. But only the chosen respond to that. So, in a very real sense, it's rooted in grace. Has to be. Jacob was determined by God to be over Esau. But it wasn't because Jacob was superior. In fact, God told Israel, you know, when you come in the land and you get all this stuff that I've planned, don't tell me or anybody else that's because you're superior to everybody else. It's not. You're a stiff-necked, hard-headed bunch of people. And all the stuff that he told them. The fact is, though, God made this decision because he'd made some promises he's going to keep. So, God's entrance into time is his act of calling, and that's the outworking of what was foreknown, what was predetermined, and it's the foundation of what's coming. So, when Jesus said, many are called, but few are chosen, he's just telling us that the calling part is pretty wide, broad. But when Paul writes about it, he's not talking about that broad calling. He's talking about what the theologians call it, an effectual calling. The kind of calling you can't resist. People say, well, Saul could have told Jesus, you know, just leave me alone, I'm not interested. He could have. That's what they say. Could he have? God knows exactly what it takes to overwhelm somebody's resistance. So, the issue of choosing is an interesting issue, but that's according to Romans, was it 9:11? That God's purpose according to the standard of election might stand. The whole point there is God had to make some decisions and he made them. And now he's actually entering into the process of fulfilling his promise. And every believer has been chosen by God, or they wouldn't be a believer. If we go to Revelation 17:14, he says there are three issues. One is calling, one is choosing, and one is believing. The called, the chosen, the faithful. Well, it's not choosing, calling, believing. It's calling, choosing, and believing. But the fact is, Paul is dealing with the central issue of in his text of where God enters into time and actually begins to fulfill the things that he has declared to be, according to before time eternity. This is what it's going to be. This is God working it out so that it will be that way. So in Revelation 17:14, he just says, there's the calling, there's the choosing, there's the believing, and you can't reject any of the three without destroying the whole chain. There's no omission, there are no additions, whatever. We just have to conclude in relation to what Jesus said, that God often calls, but he doesn't follow through with enforcing it or overwhelming the resistance. He just makes the offer, and quite frankly, he's going to use that in the judgment. He's going to say, I summoned you. I offered you this. You didn't want to hear it. And if you don't want to admit that, let's just play the tape. And it won't be overwhelmingly loud. It'll just be loud enough for everybody to hear it. And they'll see themselves being confronted by God at that point in history that God's referring to, and they will see themselves angrily, deliberately rejecting it. There will be no arguments. Every mouth will be shut down. God's going to use it in their case as judgment. In fact, he even said that to some of the people who objected to his working in some of the parables. Out of your own mouth, I will judge you. You knew that I was this way, so you should have done this. But you knew, but you didn't do this. That's your problem. You knew. You just responded improperly. The point is, for those that Romans 8:28 says, everything's being bent by God to result in ultimate good for the called according to purpose, those people, God is going to do everything that is necessary to be done to make sure that everything that we suffer, every issue that we have to face that we'd rather not, is going to be turned by him into good, which in another way was already stated in chapter 8, verse 18, where he says, there's a coming glory that's not even, I mean, you can't even compare what you had to endure with what you're getting. There's no comparison. And he wants us to believe that. That's why I wrote the words.